Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. One of the problems we're having now is that media outlets have repeatedly made baseless accusations and allegations against Israel, even when the information they use comes from Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Question you have to ask yourself, well, why do media outlets take information from Hamas as though it were true? Hamas has total disregard for truth, for morality, and yet these media, reputable media outlets continue to amplify what the terrorist group's figures are, and they repeat the claims of Hamas. First, for example, media outlets claim that Israel bombed Gaza's Al-Ahli hospital, killing 500 people. Later turned out the hospital was not hit by an Israeli strike, but was rather an Islamic Jihad misfire. Again, another example is the media rushed report that Israeli soldiers has killed 112 Palestinians at a food convoy. And the IDF, our Israeli army, investigated this, has concluded the deaths were overwhelmingly the result of a stampede when all these Gazans were trying to get food. So media outlets have all kind of allegations accusing Israeli soldiers of rape and things of that nature. All of this is fabricated in order to incite against Israel. Now, there is a new dangerous allegation that's put out by UNRWA, United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, and the Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas. They have major headlines saying that more children have been killed in Gaza in recent months than in 4 years of worldwide conflict. This is a terrible allegation. It's a lie. Nothing could be further from the truth. And it revives an age-old anti-Semitic blood libel, which has long sought to portray the Jews as killers. And it also advances anti-Semitism. So it's obvious that one of the things that's the responsibility of the Israeli government to do, the Israeli army, is to dispel all these false allegations. Now, the truth of the matter is that the United Nations has a long history of bias against Israel. The General Assembly, as well as the Human Rights Council, have all these condemned Israel in all kinds of resolutions. Incidentally, it's been reported that more than 2,000 employees of UNRWA belong to Hamas, and about 400 of them participated in the massacres in October. So none of this makes any sense. A fellow named Abraham Wiener is a statistics and data science professor at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business, and he rejected the casualty figures provided by the Hamas-run Gaza Health Agency. And he was on television on an American program. There's a program called Life, Liberty, and Levin, and he had Professor Weiner on this program. And Weiner said that the numbers are not real. The first place to look is the reported total number of deaths. The graph of total deaths, as reported by the health ministry in Gaza, is increasing with almost metronomical linearity, which means there's an even and linear increase. You don't have to be a mathematician, but the professor said an even and linear increase suggests The same number of people were killed each day during the beginning of the war in October as during the ceasefire in November. So these latest claims just make no sense. For example, between 2020 and 2022, there was a devastating conflict in Ethiopia because the government was fighting against rebels in the war. It was all kind of disaster and famine. An estimated somewhere of like 400,000 civilians died as a result of this war. The median age of Ethiopian citizens is a little less than 19 years. That means that there would have been 180,000 to 200,000 child deaths, according to half of all civilian deaths. But that figure currently exceeds Hamas's entire reported death toll in Gaza by six times. Now, obviously, every civilian casualty is a tragedy, but it should be noted at least 13,000 of those killed in Gaza were Hamas agents, according to Israeli army. So this sum, 13,000, accounts for more than a third of all the deaths currently being reported by Hamas and its propaganda. So even if you believe the numbers reported by Hamas, at least a third of them, 13,000, were killed by Israel because they were terrorists. So the question you have to raise is, why is the United Nations reporting false statistics that they take from Hamas? It's likely that all these numbers are being spread around because what they're trying to do is use it as propaganda to prevent Israel from continuing the war. So these allegations is dishonest. It's playing into classical anti-Semitic lies. For years, thousands of years, anti-Semites accused Jews of killing children. The original blood libel, which accused Jews of killing Christian children, was a major theme in Jewish persecution in Europe throughout the Middle Ages. There have been anti-Jewish riots and massacres based on these lies about Jews killing Christian children. So now we have Jewish communities being targeted by mobs as an illogical result of similar information targeting the Jewish state and Jews in Israel. So these lies are absolutely nothing used by the Muslims against Jews. In 1929, there was a leader of the Palestinians named Haji Amin al-Husseini. He was the Mufti of Jerusalem. He's regarded often as the father of Palestinian nationalism, and he accused the Jews of trying to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem during Ramadan, the holy month, which, by the way, is now. We're still in the middle of the Ramadan. The result, the lies, there were lies, but they resulted in massacres of Jews in Hebron in Jerusalem because all these Arabs were told that they have to save Al-Aqsa from the Jews. So these lies are used against the Jews. So these lies have to stop. Let's put it this way. It's not so much you can stop these guys from lying. You can't stop them from lying. But you got to try to get the journalists not to repeat the lies. All these things you're saying about Israel are false. But misinformation and disinformation at the war against Hamas have contributed to rising anti-Semitism. By the way, the number of anti-Semitic incidents just in the United States have skyrocketed by 400% since the war began on October 7th. The reputable media outlets must stop repeating the lies that they get from Hamas because they're not true, and they bring falsehoods against the Jewish state, and they increase anti-Semitism. So these are blood libels against Israel, and we have to do what we can to stop them. The fact is that internationalizing the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians and criminalizing Israel has been a central Palestinian strategy. The question is whether it is working now. It seems that the American administration may be acquiescing in this scheme in order to wedge Israel into their fantasy framework of a dangerous, indecisive end to the war. We're being pressured now by the American administration to end the war in Gaza. Now, there's no doubt that one of the things that's pushing the American, I think at least, is my opinion, one of the things that's pushing the American administration is the fact that this is an election year for President of the United States, and there's a very large Muslim population in some of the major states in the United States. So the president is doing what he can to make these Muslim populations happy, and is doing it at the expense of Israel. This is not good, but Israel has absolutely no choice but to do what is necessary for Israel. There are those who believe that it's not an exaggeration to say that Israel, right at this moment, stands at a great diplomatic inflection point. It's a pivotal moment with historical implications for Israel's long-term security. At issue is not just the question of how and when to destroy the remaining Hamas brigades in Gaza, nor is the issue humanitarian aid to Palestinians who are really trapped in a terrible position by Hamas. The question is, and it's been brought out by commentators like David Weinberg, who works with at the Mizkav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy. And he says that issue is the regional and international perception of Israel as a country capable of winning a war of self-defense, a war against the Muslim Brotherhood state that has established in Hamas. The state has genocidal plans and would try to destroy Israel unless Israel eliminates it. At issue, according to David Weinberg, who's a thinker and an expert, at issue is the regional and international perception of Israel as a country with the determination to destroy the Iranian-backed Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Hezbollah proxies that have forced Israel into repeated rounds of draining warfare since Israel was established, and particularly in the last 30 years, and which now have depopulated and destroyed significant parts of southern and northern Israel. Many people who live on the borders of Gaza, who live on the northern border, have been moved out of their homes because of the threat of Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Tens of thousands of Israelis are now not living in their homes. They're displaced. And an issue is the regional and international perception of Israel as a nation that cannot be steamrolled into diplomatic or military defeat. That Israel should be able to act on its own, its essential security needs, and be free of all of pressure that affect Israel's future. We have to free Israel of terrorist violence all over Israel. At issue are regional and international perceptions of Israel as a society that is unified, resolute, and a just society. We have a moral compass, and the other countries should want to be partners with us. We have to worry about our image. What the Biden administration doesn't seem to understand, and probably due to the fact that there's an election this year in the United States, what the Biden administration doesn't understand is Israelis are mobilized and united to win, and they want to win crushingly. This is not a simple war. This is a war for our long-term survival. Now, it's true that Biden has a personal commitment to Israel. He's been supportive of Israel for many, many years. But first of all, he's in an election year, and he's worried about his own election and the control of the Congress. And the present administration, Biden administration, does not seem to comprehend, and this is important, that what is under attack is not just Israel, but Western civilization, because we are being attacked by Islamic fundamentalists, and the war of Hamas against Israel, alongside with Hezbollah in the north, and also they have Houthi attacks coming from Yemen, they are only the front line on a broader assault on the West, on Western civilization. This is a war, a world war, and you just can't make it smaller by all kinds of the diplomacy. And this is a war that best can be won if Washington stands by natural allies like Israel instead of punishing Israel. Israel cannot knuckle under. At the moment, Israel stands alone. But that's not new. We stand alone many times. It's not desirable, nor should Israel accept this as a permanent reality. There is much Israel must do to overcome gaps between its perception of the immediate long-term challenges and those of other nations. Israel must act resolutely and to force other nations to reassess what is happening here. It's a tough time where we're having an election year in the United States, and the American administration, which has been supportive of Israel, is now being influenced by the fact that the president is running again for office in a few months, and that is to Israel's detriment. But we in Israel have to do what we have to do, no matter what it costs, because our future depends on it. I'll be back after the break.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to share some thoughts that came to me when I realized that we have been at war since the beginning of October. That's October, November, December, January, February, March. That's a lot of time we're at war. And traditionally, Israelis loved their country. Back in 1948, when it was a new country, it was first forming its social and political identity. Living through the country's beginning was very meaningful to people, because they were conscious about forging something new, something like compulsory national service, provided each Israeli with a feeling of belonging and an individual role in defending the country and actually enriching daily life. Now, Israelis were politically contentious. They argued about politics all the time because they felt that they owned the country and therefore they had an interest in it. They weren't separate from the government in a sense. It was their country. They felt close to it. They felt ownership, sometimes too much ownership, but ownership nonetheless. Now, what happened was, as the years went by, let's say about 30 or 35 years after the country was founded, the country experienced really spectacular growth, and it transferred into a global economic powerhouse and actually a military superpower. The country had arrived on the international stage. The country essentially became fabulously successful, but it became less personal and more institutional. I remember when I first came to Israel in 1969, we would drive to downtown Tel Aviv, and you felt very much at home, and it was like a small town. I went with my wife to visit for a few hours in Tel Aviv this week, and there were high-rises and skyscrapers, and it wasn't that personal feeling anymore. So we've transformed. So we're on the international stage, as I said. So we began to take the country for granted. We assumed that it was stable and secure, and secure enough to actually run on its own, strong army, etc. And we lost personal agency in day-to-day experiences. Life in Israel felt more humdrum and less meaningful as it did in the beginning, years ago. Everything was new, everything was important, and now things are taken much more for granted. Now, all of this changed on October 7th. We are now in an existential war. We're forced to take control of the future of the state more than we did before. We think more about it. We're revitalized. We have soldiers fighting in Gaza for months, and they'll probably be fighting the northern border in a couple of months, including my grandchildren. We announce, if we don't protect our homes, who will? Each Israeli citizen has a personal stake in Israel and its future. The truth of the matter is that national identification with government institutions is low. I read the newspapers every day, particularly to prepare for this program, and it's kind of boring. There's all this infighting among the politicians. But so the government is something we sort of don't pay much attention to, only the politicians do. But patriotism and support for our security forces runs very high. So this will dramatically affect the future political map of Israel. Right now, we all feel a personal involvement in the future. For 5 months, Israelis from all walks of life have kept a vigil protecting our homeland. Because if we don't defend it, who will? If we don't build our country, who will? The last 5 months have included sadness and tragedy, but it's been filled with meaning for the people. And this war has also provided something for Jews living outside of Israel, because up till now, they too, Jews living in the diaspora, took the state of Israel for granted. When I first came to Israel, traveling to Israel was very difficult. I remember the time I came with Aliyah, a lot of people came by boat from New York. It took 14 days. And my first flight to Israel, there was no nonstop flight. I took a flight that had landed in Europe, took off for Israel, the same thing going back. But today, several weeks ago, I flew to from here, from Tel Aviv, nonstop to Miami in 14 hours, something that was unheard of 50 years ago. So it's easier than ever to land in Israel for a few days, enjoy the people and the food, visit family, and go to the hotel and get inject back to regular life. I remember the old crowded and the old Ben Gurion airport. The airport was a terrible place in those days, but despite its disadvantages, the second you landed, you immediately knew you were in Israel. The heat, the smell, the cramped lines left no doubt in your mind that you were not an American anymore, you were in Israel. Now, the modest terminal that was here when I first came with Aliyah was replaced by this modern and shiny airport. Landing in Israel became similar to landing anywhere else. Now, Jewish visitors to Israel are tourists. Years ago, they were pilgrims. Now they're tourists. Over the past few years, however, it's become clear that Israel is no longer something that any Jew can take for granted. I think the shift in mentality began during the COVID crisis, because there was a time during the COVID when the people who were non-Israeli Jews couldn't come here because of health concerns. The attacks of October 7th recast the relationship between non-Israeli Jews and Jews living here by reminding everyone of just how fragile life in Israel can really be. In the last 5 months, visits to Israel have been very different from the vacations of the past. Last month, some relatives who I haven't seen in years came with a group of people to do volunteer work. Just as I was preparing this program, I got a message from someone staying in a hotel not far from where I live, who's never been to Israel before, that they're here to do volunteer work and they'd like to visit with me. So the shopping and restaurant meals have been replaced by volunteerism and trips to see the charred remains of the communities in the south. So in a sense, Jews traveling to Israel are not simply tourists anymore. They become more like pilgrims. I think, and that's the point I wanted to make, this war has reminded everyone, particularly Jews, that they are not shareholders in Israel and not external spectators. The country is dependent upon all of us, not only those who live here, but those who relate to us and who understand us. So the war has been, I think, a great change in the mentality of Jews living not only in Israel, but outside of Israel. As I think I mentioned in the past, I have distant relatives. I don't even remember what they look like. But when this war started, a couple of weeks after the war started, they contacted me for the first time in years to see how I am. All our relationships have changed since this war. So what's going to happen in the future, I don't know. Only God knows. But things will never be the same after October 7th, nor should they be. I want to say a few general words about the war that began on October 7th. The ground maneuver began about 5 months ago on October 27th. So there's a lot of information that we've learned. There are essentially three phases of the war in Gaza. And then phase one was the ground maneuver from October 27th to November 24th. It was a month long. That was the highest intensity phase of the war. And it started with an intense bombing of Gaza. That part of the war received a lot of international attention with accusations that it was too widespread. It led to a lot of destruction, caused civilian casualties. The battle for northern Gaza was led by two large Israeli army divisions. When northern Gaza was mostly taken, the 12 Hamas battalions had been defeated. The battles in the north of Gaza involved the tanks and churning up roads and urban fighting. And most civilians had been asked to evacuate in October, so there weren't many civilians in the areas where the tanks went in. And the people returned, though, in January and February. So by March, some 300,000 people were in northern Gaza, and Hamas returned with them. So that was the first phase. The second phase started in December and January with a big operation around a place called Khan Yunis. This is more focused, involving more commanders. Civilians were warned to leave before troops entered, and the troops then moved slowly neighborhood by neighborhood to find tunnels and defeat Hamas. And at least four more Hamas battalions were defeated. Now, we're in the next phase, the third phase, and it has to do with the battle for Rafah, which is a main headquarters for the terrorists. Now, it's tough. Question is, what tactics will be used? And that's something the army has to decide. There are some people that said that some commentators claimed that our army, the IDF, purposely let Hamas return to these areas in order to catch them later by surprise. And there's a place called Shifra, for instance. There were around 1,000 terrorists returned to a hospital, and our army raided the place without telling the people first. So the question is, what's going to happen next? I understand from the newspapers that America wants us to have a slow, phased precision campaign. An article in the U.S. Department of Defense this week said, regarding Rafah, a significant portion of the meeting with the Israelis focused on Israel's concept of operations in the city, and with Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin expressing the United States' goal is to help Israel find an alternative to a full-scale military operation that could potentially endanger the city's civilian population. So what's happening is the American leadership has met with the Israeli leadership, and the Americans are trying to give us direction how to undertake this last campaign in that area, so not too many people were killed. It's hard to understand what the alternative to full-scale military operation means. That's what we're told the Americans are insisting on. Does it mean precision raids by special forces or a slow maneuver street by street? I don't know what it all means. The United States had experience in a lot of foreign countries like Afghanistan, but they didn't do too well there. So wonder whether our army can take any directions or advice from them. So it appears that the level of destruction that America did in places like Afghanistan would not be accepted by the United States. Israel do the same here. Israel doesn't want to kill too many people. The overall issue now in the finishing off this war in Gaza is the timing. Interestingly enough, the United States is sending personnel and ships to build a temporary pier off the coast of Gaza. However, it won't be completed until mid or late April. So concerns about humanitarian aid entering Gaza will overshadow the operation. The problem is that most of the aid is now being delivered and Hamas is allowed to hijack the aid. Around 250 trucks enter Rafah every day, with another 30 or so entering northern Gaza. The goal will be to shift this movement of trucks and aid in such a way that it meets the needs of the civilians, because the civilians will have to be moved during any campaign Israel does to finish off this job. A phased campaign would require phases of moving maybe 50,000 civilians and meeting their needs. It's a tough thing. Hamas apparently calculates that Israel does not have time on its side, that all Hamas has to do is persevere and wait for another few months, and it will win, and Israel will not accomplish its objectives. Israel will be forced to relax. So it's defeating this will require a lot more than just a phased precision operation going after the Hamas chooses to leave behind there. This is a very, very tough decision for the Israeli government to make because, among other things, there's an American election coming, and there's going to be a lot of pressure from America not to do what we feel has to be done. I just wanted to share with the listeners some of my thoughts. I'm not a strategic expert, but as a civilian watching what's going on, I hope that the people in charge have enough sense to know how to handle this so that we win the war without losing the support of any of our friends outside the country. I just wanted to share these thoughts with the listeners. I'll be back after the break.
Warning. Take cover. The Jewish Truth Bomb is here. The show that will explode all the false narratives and fake news. Join host Lenny Goldberg each week as he wires the news together and detonates it through biblical verses that will deliver a shockwave that will blow you away. Don't miss it. The Jewish Truth Bomb. Every Monday.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. Thanks again for listening. There is a controversy going on in Israel now about Haredi conscription. Now, Haredi, I'm not quite sure how you define Haredi, but generally, when the word Haredi appears, it's described in English as ultra-Orthodox. And it's hard to know what ultra-Orthodox is, how religious people are, how Orthodox they are. Generally, we describe them according to the way they're dressed. If they wear black hats and black suits and have beards and so forth, we consider them Haredi. That doesn't really mean that. But these are apparently people who belong to different groups, who go to certain yeshivot or schools that are known as Haredi schools. So there are people who are known as Haredim. And the problem is, or the issue is, that a lot of the Haredim don't serve in the army. And there is something like 60,000 people who don't serve in the army who are eligible in terms of their age. And this is a big controversy here in Israel. When the country first came into being, it was agreed that those students who are studying in yeshivot and schools of religious higher learning should be exempt. There were about 400 students at that time. And the reason was, and it made a lot of sense, was after the destruction of Jewry in Europe during the Second World War, after the Holocaust, it was needed that there be religious schools giving Jewish education so that the Judaism could survive. Without education, you can't have Judaism. At the beginning, as I said, there were like 400 students, but now the number has grown to something like 60 or 61,000. And it's become a big discussion here in Israel. That right now, the Israeli army, the IDF, confronts a situation that it does not have at its disposal sufficient manpower to successfully implement all the urgent tasks that it confronts in a situation which today means ongoing fighting in the Gaza Strip, growing unrest in Judea and Samaria, and the possibility of the six-month cross-border skirmishes with Hezbollah in Lebanon turning into a full-scale war. So we could actually be having a war in three fronts, on Gaza, Judea and Samaria, and Hezbollah. So right now we have a real war going on in the Gaza Strip. We have terrorism in Judea and Samaria, and we have every now and then fighting back and forth or shooting back and forth on the Lebanese border. So in order to confront this situation, the Israeli army has already called up reservists who have only recently turned home after up to 4 months of duty since the war started in October. Now, many of these soldiers, that is, and I have 12 of my grandchildren have been called in, and some are called back, still are serving on active duty. These who recently turned home after up to 4 months of duty, and they're experiencing serious economic difficulties as a result. Many of them have had to close their businesses. Others have lost their jobs. And the army is planning to prolong the mandatory service of men to 3 years. It had been apparently beforehand had been shortened from 36 months to 32 months back in 2015. And the army is planning to prolong the period of mandatory reserve duty from the age of 45 to 46 for officers, and from 40 to 41 for non-officers. I myself served in the I myself served in the reserves up until the age of 53, and after that it was reduced, but now they're going to raise it again. And the length of the annual reserve duty is going to be raised very significantly. So as far as the Israeli army is concerned, an increase in mobilization of Haredim for full military service would greatly relieve the problem. Every year, some 12,000 Haredi 18-year-olds are eligible for military service, but less than 10% of them actually turn up to serve, mostly among youth who are no longer practicing Haredim. Following October 7th, there was a feeling in the general public that the catastrophe would bring about some changes in the Haredi approach to the security situation, and the Haredim would see the importance of military service. As though there was undoubtedly some change, and only for a short while, the number of slightly older Haredi men over the age of 26 who volunteered for a shortened 2-week basic training course to be followed by some form of reserve duty increased very slightly, but the numbers were much lower than was expected and was hoped for. And the problem was that the practice was actively discouraged by the Haredi religious and political leadership. So this is going to change. And whether or not the decision of the High Court of Justice came up with a decision that the Haredim will have to serve. The obviously, on the whole, the non-Haredi population, whether we're talking about the secular or the traditional or the national religious, they do not object to a certain number of Haredim being allowed to study rather than serve. If they're really prodigies, because we need Torah. There are secular counterparts in secular universities who are allowed to not serve in the army because they're doing, let's say, research that's vital for the country. In other words, if someone is doing research or in a sense, learning, which is also a form of research that is vital for the country, they should be allowed not to serve. But that has to be a very small number of people who are very good at what they do. So whether or not the decision for the High Court of Justice will actually bring a real change in the situations that existed since the establishment of the state in 1948 is yet to be seen. I don't know, are we going to experience a major revolution? But because the current government is likely to come up with some kind of mechanism that will avoid the problem. So it is a real problem. That incidentally, the traditional position of most of the Ashkenazi Haredi religious leaders was and remains that religious studies and prayers of the Haredim contribute to Israel's security at least as much, if not more, than the IDF and the fighting capabilities. And they systematically object to their youth joining the IDF. The religious leaders look upon the Israeli army as sort of a secular organization that will have a negative influence on their students. Incidentally, there's a group called the Jerusalem Faction, which has about 60,000 members, and it's one of the most extreme Haredi groups in Israel. The head of it, Rabbi Tzvi Friedman, recently stated in a conversation initiated by two members of an organization called Brothers in Arms that these are secular Jews who want to see the Haredim participate in the army service. So in a conversation with them, Rabbi Tzvi Friedman said he would prefer that his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren be killed by Arabs rather than join a secular institution such as the army and become secular. So he's more worried about them becoming secular than they're being killed. Now, that is the Ashkenazi. Ashkenazi generally refers to the Jews who come from Eastern Europe. But there is Sfaradim, the Jews who come from the Arab countries. There is an organization, a political organization called Shas, which is the Sfaradi Haredi Party. It's generally more moderate than the Ashkenazi counterparts. As a matter of fact, the Shas now has members of Knesset. There are 11 members of Knesset belonging to the Shas party, and three served in the army. One actually did national service. But even there, the Shah's party, there are extreme positions on the issue of enlistment. In his weekly sermon about a month ago to Sephardi chief rabbi, Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, stated that if we shall be forced to go to the army, we shall all go to outside the country. So, obviously, most of the people, even in the traditional or the secular or the national religious part, don't object, as I said a moment ago, to a certain number of Haredim prodigies being allowed to study rather than serve in the army. But it is a real question now. Israel needs military men now, military men and military women. And the fact there are 60,000 people who are free from serving the army, that's a serious problem. And it's a problem that's going to have to be resolved very soon, because we are in a critical situation. Country's in danger. So I just wanted to present, as I understand the what's happening in this Haredi conscription problem. Or maybe I shouldn't call it a problem. It's an issue. And it's going to hit the headlines a lot in the next coming weeks, for sure. Now I want to go over to a totally different subject. It has to do with how the diaspora Jewry has rallied to collect money to help Israel since this war began. A report was issued a few days ago by the diaspora ministry, and it described the number of donations and the manpower that have come from Jews all around the world since the war started. They put out a report and it tracked donations and support, and the findings revealed that a total of about $1.41 billion have been raised, and approximately 60,000 volunteers came to Israel, which pretty much signals a broad mobilization of diaspora Jews, including financial activities and on the public diplomacy front. By the way, it's very interesting. I mentioned it a few minutes ago that there are 60,000 yeshiva students here in Israel who are exempt from the army, but approximately 60,000 volunteers came from outside the country, just roughly the same number. Very interesting. The Jewish Federations of North America raised approximately half those funds. It's half. That's about half of $1.417 billion. Donations from independent federations were also raised, like the New York Federation, which raised $73 million, and it's ranked among the highest among North American donors. Large donation centers also in Chicago and Toronto, which raised a lot, $50 million each. They're also collecting funds through what's called crowdfunding. About $91 million was raised by crowdfunding. The report that was put out, as I said, by the Diaspora Ministry categorized the donations to understand which parts of Israel society were assisted through the war. Medical and emergency services received a total of about $220 million, which is about 19% of the total funds raised. Another substantial category was for civil activities in the evacuated Gaza Strip border communities and victims of terrorism and bereaved families, which included contributions in the field of psychological assistance and care. And there were the other significant donations were assisting Holocaust survivors, educational institutions. So support for Israel came from across the entire world, especially from North America and Western Europe. That's where most of the world's Jews reside, outside of Israel. Already in the earliest days of the war in October, countless Israelis themselves volunteered to support civil initiatives, and delegations of foreign volunteers came from to join us. They worked for farmers, agricultural industry. They helped residents of the border areas who had been evacuated to hotels. Organizations support diaspora Jews. There were many organizations that did so. I don't know if the names mean anything to the listeners. There's Taglit, Hashomer HaChadash, Sar'el, Leket Israel. They volunteer primarily in the Israeli agriculture and industry sectors and assisted evacuees from southern and northern parts of the country. And also Sar'el, which is an organization devoted to bringing volunteers to do Army-style service, they reported within the first 5 months of the war, there was an uptick of 6 times the number of volunteers. These are people who come to Israel. They'd be here for a week or a week and a, or 2 weeks, and they work in the Army camps. So we can say that the solidarity of Jews worldwide has moved us more than any financial contribution. What happens is the issue is the identification of Jews around the world in the state of Israel. Just the answer to anti-Semitism, I think, is to ensure the ability to defend ourselves. The victory in the war is critical for the security of Jews around the world. There's no two ways about that. I'll be back after the break.
Be smart. Listen to Israel News Talk Radio in the background while you work and get the latest news and commentary from Israel. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to spend a few minutes thinking philosophically with the listeners. The question is, why are the Palestinians terrorists against Israel? If the Palestinians had a state, would they stop being terrorists? I don't think so. Israel has to first examine Palestinian violence in terms of the human need to belong to something. This was pointed out by Louis René Barrès, who is a thinker, and he said that there is a compelling need in human beings to belong to something, to belong to a sports team, or to go to with groups to rock concerts, or in a sense with the Palestinians, they want to belong to a terrorist group. The Hamas murders that took place a few months ago were pretty bad. They were barbarous and really inexcusable. What does this have to do with a Palestinian demand for a two-state solution? It reveals the demands based upon misinformation and subterfuge. Not only would a Palestinian state fail to halt Palestinian terrorism, it would render these kind of things more likely and more injurious. In other words, if Israel was to allow the Palestinians to have a state, they wouldn't stop being terrorists. They would have a state of terrorists. So the question is, Barrès quoted Aristotle, and he said, man is a social animal. Even normal individuals can feel empty and insignificant unless they belong to something. Sometimes the mass that they want to belong to is the state itself. Sometimes it's a tribe. Sometimes it belongs to some religion, You belong to a group. In the case of Palestinian terror violence, it's the state. They want to belong to something which is a terrorist state. There's a craving for belonging that threatens to produce the downfall of individual responsibility, and it adds to what could be called collective criminality. People want to belong to something. If the something they want to belong to is something criminal, they're going to be criminals. So in jihadist-centered parts of the Middle East, the belonging is generally something that they want to be part of and therefore will act according to what the group does. They want to belong, and since, unless millions can finally stop the all-consuming psychological desire to belong, then all military, legal, and political schemes to control violent terrorism will fail, because people want to belong, and in this case, they want to belong to a violent terrorist group. To more understand what lies behind Palestinian terrorism against Israel, they have to look more deeply behind the news to explain the susceptible individuals turned into murderous gangs. In the jihadist Middle East, neither terrorism nor war could possibly take place in the absence of some corrosive identifications. People want to belong to something. The Beres goes on to say, he quotes from Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, whenever individuals crowd together and form a mass, the exterminatory dynamics of a dangerous mob could be unleashed. People want to belong to something, and if they want to belong to a mob that murders, they will become murderers. Every single person's moral and intellectual level is lowered to a point where even anonymous mass killing would be welcome and encouraged. So what happened in October, the attack upon vulnerable Israeli civilians? In today's jihad-oriented Middle East, Islamic faith is being placed in the service of terror violence. At its core, Hamas terror against Israel is fueled by effectively divine will, they say. Ironically, the net result of such calling on divine will is to drown out any sacredness or godliness. For Hamas and other jihadists, they join a murdering mass, and in the particular case of Jews, moreover, human sentiments must be suppressed and punished if to act against Jews. These people live in a morally upside-down universe, and empathy and compassion become extraneous, but they're against their religion and against their politics. In the name of what they consider divine commandment, jihadist terror crimes offer the wider world neither salvation nor holiness, but they give them group enjoyment and group think and a feeling of belonging. So it's pretty futile, according to Luray Beres, for Israel to advance even the sincerest efforts at elementary human cooperation. This basic policy dilemma can't be solved by any expert. True solutions will require the concentrated intellectual efforts of thinkers. For Israel, it could emerge that any alleged two-state solution would only be another final solution. To undertake meaningful investigations of Hamas terrorism, that they have to look more closely at the determinants of human meaning. Before we can slow down terror violence against Israel, Hamas and people like Hamas had to be taken out of their goal to give celebrity status upon murderers. In other words, people want to belong to something, and in the case of Hamas, they want to belong to a group that's murderous. They want to become murderers, and it makes them proud. These mass-directed individuals who turn to terrorism for affirmations of their personal worth, they have to need to identify how there can be other sources of belonging. In other words, as I understand this, I'm trying to share my understanding with the listeners, these people want to belong. In the case of Hamas, for example, they want to belong to a group of murderers, and therefore they want to be murderers so they can have a feeling of belonging. And even furthermore, these people, what happens is these individuals don't find meaning in their own lives only by joining a group. In this case, a group of murderers. And Gaza and other directed Palestinian areas, the faithful had to present tangible proof of belonging. And any such presentation, participation in violence against Israelis is a meritorious act. Accordingly, the highest status a Palestinian jihadist fighter can acquire is by ritualistic murder is that of a shaheed or martyr. In other words, you belong to the group by becoming like the group. That is, you become like the murderers. And if the Israelis kill you because they caught you because you're a murderer, then you go to their heaven. You're a martyr. So at its heart, Palestinian terrorism against Israel is a problem of displaced belonging of human beings. What they're trying to do, these people, find meaning in their own lives. So Hamas adherence draw closer to a mass-based defilement of unbelievers. You belong more to the believers when you can show that you kill unbelievers. So, in other words, in a blood-soaked society, the voice of anti-reason can make even the most sordid forms of terror killing appear glorious. So, according to Beres, when it is correctly understood as a form of religious sacrifice, Hamas terrorism promises to confirm more than just belonging, promises the greatest conceivable form of power, the power of immortality, or the power over death. So, lest anyone forget the heroic death that Palestinian martyrs expect to suffer is never anything more than an inconvenience on the path to everlasting life. In essence, it ought never to be forgotten by Israelis that the Palestinian Shaheed kills himself in order to live forever somewhere else in the other world. At birth, each person contains the possibility of becoming fully human. That's an opportunity to reduce potential destructive loyalties to any particular murderous mass. What these people are looking for is a feeling of belonging. And in order to belong, you have to act like the mob. So the question is, what do we do? In principle, Israel's long-term struggle against Hamas and other jihadists should be framed to encourage potential terror killers to discover a way to be themselves as human beings. But the question is, could you tell these people that it's not good for them to belong to the mob that they want to belong to? So according to Beres, it's time to apply analytic summation. Israel should never misunderstand or represent the core causes of Palestinian terror. And this is the bottom line. Hamas killers cannot, excuse me, Hamas killers are not fundamentally interested in sovereignty or self-determination or statehood. Rather, these criminals seek their satisfaction in personal belonging, pretended heroism, and faith-defined immortality. In other words, it's not just a political thing. These people define themselves by belonging to a terrorist group. So, for the immediate future, obviously, Israel will need to continue its Life 7 military response to terrorism, especially when Hamas leaders remain determined to sacrifice the entire Palestinian civilian population. If Hamas leaders really believe their own sacred promise to martyrs of life everlasting, why are they unwilling to sacrifice themselves and their families for the sake of Palestine? Why do they choose instead to inhabit luxury hotel suites in Qatar or the United Arab Emirates in Saudi Arabia? And it's hard for Israelis to understand what would that the Arabs are not looking for statehood. They're looking essentially for self-identification. If self-determination and sovereignty have ever been the true objectives, Palestinian leadership over the past 50 years would have acted very differently. They would have not have rejected all the Israeli offers of Palestinian statehood. They want to kill Jews, and they want to define themselves. So, in other words, what Louis Rene Burris is saying is that Palestinian statehood would not stop terrorism, because there is a psychology that the people have that will continue to define themselves as trying to destroy Israel. Now, I don't know whether Burris is right or not, but it's interesting. I came across an article that he's written, and as I said, the bottom line is they're not looking for statehood; they're looking for self-definition. So, giving them a state won't give a solution to the problem. One of their definitions is to destroy Israel. They're looking for belonging to a gang with the same self-definition. Now, I don't know how true all this is, but I came across this article, and I wanted to share it with the listeners because it's interesting, at least. As far as Israel's concerned, the Israelis have not been broken, won't succumb to Hamas's celebration of murder. On the contrary, the heroism of our soldiers proven every day and every hour, and the internal resilience of the Israeli people guaranteed a defeat of our enemy. The premeded Hamas massacre of October 7th means that there should be no unilateral ceasefire until Israel has achieved absolute victory. Until then, the United States should let Israel do what it has to do and would do if faced with a new enemy whose calling card is a culture of death and destruction. Despite all too expected deplorable behavior of the United Nations, it really behooves the American administration and indeed the entire Western world to remember that what happened was important to Israel. We are part of the Western world. We are on the front line of the battle of the Western world to survive against Islam, which is a major danger to Western society. And we are in the front row, the front line, and the Americans should support us because we are defending them and all of Western society. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Jay Shapiro signing off.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.